from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, pioneering UCSF AIDS researcher Arthur Ammon will join us. We'll discuss his new book, Lethal Decisions, The Unnecessary Deaths of Women and Children from HIV/AIDS. Then at 10:30, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Megan Marshall will join us to talk about her new biography of beloved poet Elizabeth Bishop. She actually knew Bishop personally, gained access to some of her private correspondences, and we'll discuss the very private American poet whose lesbianism was a carefully guarded secret at the time. It's all coming up on Forum after the news. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the Forum program. By 1996, pioneering HIV/AIDS researcher Arthur Ammon says all of the scientific advances, tools, and knowledge necessary to eradicate AIDS were in place. And soon after, in the United States, where physicians began to treat HIV-infected patients with potent antiretroviral drugs, AIDS-related hospitalizations and deaths dropped dramatically. But in poor countries, the number of HIV infections and deaths continues to increase into the millions, and Dr. Ammon chronicles the moral, institutional, and medical failures that led to the now three-decades-old global HIV/AIDS epidemic in his new book, Lethal Decisions, The Unnecessary Deaths of Women and Children from HIV/AIDS. Dr. Ammon joins us here in studio for this half-hour segment to talk about the book and his prescription for ending the global AIDS crisis, and good to have you back with us on Forum.
Welcome. Well, thank you, Michael.
I want to begin by talking actually with you a little bit about what you get into in your book before you take on the global AIDS crisis, and that is the sense of some of the obstacles. And I mean, your book kind of takes or begins where Randy Schilt's book left off in many ways, and the battles were incredible. I mean, just to review them in my own mind and go through them, I mean, you're up against people who thought it was, first of all, it was a gay disease. It was not transmitted by transfusions. The whole blood industry seemed to be against you. A lot of the funding seemed to be against you. I mean, it was a big mountain to climb.
Yeah, I mean, it was not only a puzzle to me, but it was a disappointment, because I've always felt that as a scientist, as a clinical researcher, if you had the data, if you had the answers, that people would just take that and believe that. But there was an incredible denialism. Some of it came from the scientific community and some of it outside the community. Thankfully, Randy Schultz, in his book And the Band Played On, chronicled that early part of the epidemic that the gay community had to go through. But we were there, too, on the scientific side of people not believing the data, saying you're exaggerating the situation to get funding. And that was, to me, a big disappointment. But thankfully, much of those battles were won here in this country, and we see the impact of those victories.
A lot of those battles were won because of local people like you, and these names rise up to the top, people like Mark Conant and Paul Volberding and Jay Levy, and a lot of the activists as well, I mean, who really turned things around.
Well, the activists played an extraordinary role, and I think people don't fully appreciate how desperately we need activism in almost every area of health. They were able to go to the meetings. They went to the FDA. They went to NIH with us. We sat at the same tables and we argued, you know, we've got the answers, but this is a big epidemic and we need drugs. We need them now. We can't have delays in getting the access to these drugs. And so that had an impact, as you mentioned, by 1996. I mean, it's incredible to watch this epidemic has evolved.
You needed revenue, too. And actually, UC was withholding and the feds were withholding. And there's a story about Willie Brown actually coming to the fore here and getting about $3 million.
Yeah, he took us – Willie Brown came and took us to his office in Los Angeles and we wrote out a grant. And I had the audacity, as Randy points out in his book, to criticize the university for withholding the funds. And got punished for that. But you keep going on because the issue is big. And when you see women and children suffering, that's my side of the story, is I'm a pediatrician, is you just can't tolerate that degree of injustice that's occurring for a disease that we now can prevent and we can treat. We've seen the remarkable changes in this country.
5 years in San Francisco, not one infected baby.
Not one infected baby in 5 years in the city. And we're seeing that across the country. It started off with 2,000 infants infected in the U.S., and now we're down to less than 100. So what I wrestle with is...
Global.
Global. I mean, this epidemic, 1.5 million women and children get infected every single year since 1996. And we've had the answers to stop this epidemic. So the question is, what happened? You know, with this crescendo of excitement, we have the drugs, over 20 drugs by 1996. We have ways of diagnosing it. We can treat it. We can prevent it. And yet, since 1996, the epidemic marches on. As Randy would say, the band plays on. I'd say the epidemic marches in, mostly for us in poor, disadvantaged women and children.
Well, in fact, I want to get to the global side of this, but here in the United States, I was reading an article in Slate about how the Affordable Care Act has been a clinical bulwark against rising HIV rates and what it would mean, in effect, because it probably by the end of this week will be repealed, at least a lot of it will be repealed. A lot of these impoverished, tens of thousands actually affected if it's repealed.
Well, I mean, that's the other side of the epidemic, too. I mean, we can't say that we've been completely successful in this country. When I see what's happening, especially in southern states, how do people get diagnosed as HIV infected? How do they get the drugs? It's a battle. And if we lose the protection that has been built into the healthcare system for them, we will have an epidemic much like we have currently globally in poor countries. It's as if there's a separate population in this country, mostly people of color, who have trouble accessing HIV and the epidemic in this country, although there are enormous successes.
Or knowing what's necessary to prevent new HIV infections.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
But you know, President Clinton was pretty strong for a while in terms of global, even President Bush, unexpectedly, by many people's lights, was pretty strong about doing something to really ameliorate the global AIDS epidemic. And yet, we're kind of at a standstill now. We're kind of in limbo. Why is that?
Well, it's not only frustrating, it's painful, Michael. It's painful to see when I sit here in San Francisco, it's like I'm wearing one hat and I have everything that I need to slow the epidemic and to treat and to prevent. And then I can get on a plane and in 24 hours be in a poor country, Zimbabwe, the Congo where we work, Democratic Republic of Congo. And we still can't get the drugs. We still can't get the diagnostic tests. And I say, why, when so much money has been poured into this epidemic? And it's not the usual culprits that people come up with, but the lethal decisions that I talk about in the book were decisions that were made by people who should have known better. I mean, they knew how to stop this epidemic, and they came up with recommendations, or in some cases, my community, the academic community, conducted research studies that actually slowed the progress that we had been made and perhaps even perpetuated the epidemic.
Unconscionable, really.
Yeah.
So how do we reverse that?
Well, I think we've got to talk about accountability. You know, let me tell you one of the decisions that was disastrous, that's hard to understand. So here we are in 1996 at the Vancouver meeting, and everyone is saying what I just said. You know, we have the drugs, 20. We know how to prevent. We know how to treat. The impact was already being seen in the U.S. So 6 years later, WHO comes out with their first recommendations for treatment in poor countries. And you pick up those guidelines, and it says, if you diagnose HIV infection in an individual in a poor country, and I'll keep using that word, developing country, don't start the drug treatment until they have advanced disease or until their immune system is impaired. I mean, this was unprecedented in the history of medicine. We have never, as physicians, withheld treatment for an infectious disease until somebody gets sicker. And we've never held insulin from a diabetic or cancer treatment from someone who has cancer until the disease metastasizes. So what happened? I mean, how could this organization make recommendations for poor countries that withhold the treatment? And they may have had their own reasons for doing it, but I still don't understand it. It's an enigma. But because of that decision, the HIV that was in untreated people perpetuated until they got AIDS, and then they finally got treatment. In most cases, it was too late. So we had millions of people that were denied treatment, that were withheld treatment.
We're talking with Arthur Emmon, who is a pioneer in AIDS research and who is with us in studio. His book is Lethal Decisions, The Unnecessary Deaths of Women and Children from HIV/AIDS. This is a half-hour segment, so if some of you would like to weigh in with questions or comments, I invite you to do that now. Our toll-free number is available, and we do welcome your involvement in the conversation or any questions or comments you might have. The number to call is 866-733-6786, and again, we welcome your calls now, 866-733-6786. You can also, of course, join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and clicking on this segment, and you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Many ways you can become involved, and we do want to hear your questions and comments and your thoughts about what Dr. Emmon, Professor Emmon, clearly feels is unnecessary in the way of deaths of thousands of, and we really are talking about thousands of women and children, women and children first. At least that's what they tell you aboard the ships. There's also been, I just want to touch on this if I could with you, Arthur, this 30-year frustration over finding a vaccine. And now there's been some, at least recently, talk about some positive. There's a study, I guess, out of Barcelona that's been somewhat positive.
Yeah, right, right. And they're doing a big study in South Africa, some 1,000 patients with a vaccine candidate.
So are we moving forward, as you see?
Well, it's a move forward, and you can't stop it. But my, you know, my question is, what are you going to do while you're working on the vaccine? And we have a tendency to look to the future and see that as a solution when we're not doing what we need to do now. So here we have drugs that cost $100 a year. I mean, that's less than a vaccine that could be given to an HIV-infected pregnant woman and prevent 99% of the infections of babies. I mean, we have that now. And less than 50% of women who are HIV-infected and pregnant get that drug. And why is that? And part of it is we've lost the activism, or as Camus says in his book, The Plague, he said we've lost the fleshy substance of this. I mean, we felt the epidemic in the early phases. We knew the names of the people who died of HIV/AIDS. But now we talk about 1 million die this year, 1 million plus or minus 500,000. So we need to view these women and children as value. I mean, I think
Well, human beings rather than statistics.
Yeah. And why can't they get the same drugs that we have in this country? I mean, why do physicians in this country sit with a patient and say, I have medicine that will keep you from getting sick and keep your baby from getting infected, and then go to Africa and do a research study and withhold those same medicines from people? I mean, their obligation is to defend those people. So your question about the vaccine, yeah, but it's going to be 10 years, 20 years before a vaccine will ever get to these people. We can't even get drugs that cost only $100 a year to the people. So we've got to find a way to solve that.
And I'm going to go to your calls in just a moment here. First, a quick comment and get your response to this, Dr. Emmon. Paul writes, Ronald Reagan is completely responsible for the explosion of HIV/AIDS in the United States. He could have acted immediately to stop the rise of the disease.
Right. I was there when Ronald Reagan mentioned the word AIDS for the first time at a fundraiser that Elizabeth Glazer had. And some people were upset because Elizabeth cheered Ronald Reagan, but it was a step in the right direction. But that was followed with responses by President Bush and President Clinton in terms of recognizing the importance of helping these poor countries. The PEPFAR program was the biggest program ever in the world attacking a single disease, and it had an impact.
I think it took Rock Hudson's getting AIDS to move Ronald Reagan in that direction.
That was the influence of Rock Hudson and Elizabeth Taylor. I mean, that was the entertainment community. But it points out you need advocates, Michael. The thing I'm so frustrated with is who defends these women and children in poor countries to get the medicines. We have situations where they will, in a research study, enroll 3,000 men, women, and children testing a drug right now this year, a monoclonal antibody that has no evidence of efficacy. It's going to cost $200 million to do the study. And they're enrolling women and children who are not going to get the drugs that could keep them well or prevent transmission to the baby. Why is that? I mean, what's happened to us as researchers and academicians that we can now turn away from this epidemic when we know what the answer is? So we've got to find ways. Activism, yes. We've got to find ways to get these drugs to the people that need them. And we can do it. You know, John Kennedy said we can eradicate poverty. all we do is lack the will. And I say we can control HIV. All we do is we lack the will to do it now. It's too distant from us.
That's part of the problem, I think. Let me bring some of our callers in here. Let me go to Sam. Sam, you're on. Welcome.
Hi, I have a question. So I wanted to ask that what gender is mostly affected and highly affected in the United States? Is it men highly affected to HIV or women? Thank you. That's my question.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Ammon.
Well, in the U.S., it dominates males. The mistake that was made was that initially it was stereotyped as a disease, an infection that only affected gay men. And that delayed the discovery, I think, of HIV and AIDS in women and children. In resource-poor countries, of course, women and children represent more than 50% of the epidemic. So that's the difference between the U.S. And poor countries.
There's a different strain in Africa, though, isn't there?
There's a different strain, and there was some evidence that they may behave differently. But when you analyze the data and look at it carefully, what you really see is that it's really behavior. It's multiple sexual partners in both cases, whether it's a gay infection or whether it's infection of heterosexuals.
But you've also got countries, I mean, culturally, where they believe, for example, deflowering a virgin will cure AIDS.
Exactly.
And all of these
kinds. Yeah.
And you've got South Africa, where actually the head of state said, you know, we don't have an AIDS problem. It's not something that we have to take or acknowledge. And you have, in these countries, a lot of corruption, too.
There's corruption, and denialism is there again. When we talked about it at the beginning, denying that this was a problem, was only a gay disease, it was called initially. But there's also denialism now, Michael, which is very disturbing. And we get worried about, for example, Ebola, and rightly so. But we had one case of Ebola in the U.S. There were 8,000 to 10,000 deaths from Ebola, and it's gone now. But 8,000 deaths is what happens in several days in poor countries. I mean, we're talking about millions of people every single year for the last 20-plus years that are getting infected. And it's like, what's happened? I mean, again, it's lost its reality, and we've turned away from people that desperately need our help. They need our help both in advocacy and politically and economically and from a health point of view. They're alone. They cannot do these things on their own.
Again, if you've just joined us, our guest is Arthur Ammon. Professor Ammon is founder of Global Strategies. He's also clinical professor of pediatrics at UCSF and has written a book called Lethal Decisions, The Unnecessary Death of Women and Children from HIV/AIDS. And we'll go to more of your calls. Anne joins us next. Anne, you're on.
Thank you. I'm a public health professor at San Jose State University, and I would like to counter something with all due respect that your guest said, that never before in the history have we withheld medication from people when we knew that there was a cure. I'd like to talk about the experiments in Tuskegee with African Americans. We knew that penicillin would cure syphilis, and yet we withheld medication from that population. So there have been other times in our history, unfortunately, when we have done these unethical things. And I'd just like to make sure that people understand that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you for that. And she's correct.
Yeah, you're correct. And I actually appreciate that comment. I hesitated to mention it because I've been accused of using what's called the T word, the Tuskegee. But you're correct. It wasn't only Tuskegee. But when Susan Reverby from Wesley College looked into the Tuskegee affair, which was withholding penicillin from men of color, I mean, again, they were poor men in this country, she uncovered the Guatemala experiments, which were even worse. And these experiments all had the design of withholding known effective treatment in minority populations, treatment that they knew they were affected, and sponsored by the U.S. government. So it wasn't just Tuskegee, it was Guatemala as well. And I'd like to agree with you, because WHO's decision, and when we do research, coupled with research that we do in poor countries where we deliberately withhold effective treatment, we're recreating Tuskegee, but not at a level of less than 1,000 people. Hundreds of thousands of people were now involved. And it requires investigation, I think. Why are we doing this? You can't seem to stop it is the problem. And that's where I have the frustration. No matter what I say to NIH or I go to the Office of Human Protection, which is the highest level I can go to in the government, they just turn and say we're not doing anything unethical.
You don't necessarily expect any more largesse from the Trump administration?
I would be worried the way they would take it. They might take it and turn it around, Michael. I mean, we're here to defend the women and children. I don't think that that's the political interest right now. I mean, we're dealing with what in this country we're dealing with women, how they're viewed and how they're treated, and we're dealing with people of color, how they're viewed and they're treated, and the value of human life. And I think those are issues now in this country that are coming to the front, and I'm hoping that those issues will also bring in some of the global issues of our views.
Well, I just want to say one more thing about what I alluded to earlier, that is this research has come out of Spain, particularly out of Barcelona, because apparently she mentioned the T word and it set off my mind to remembering that they were talking about re-educating T cells to control the virus with this. Yeah. This vaccine that's been tested, at least, and actually supposedly can boost the immune system, but we'll have to wait and see. Here's Kent who says, can you talk about the small portion of HIV patients who are classified as non-progressors? I've been HIV plus for 8 years. My doctor and I regularly monitor my numbers and have not yet found it necessary to begin medication.
Yeah, well, that's a genetic part of the epidemic, that there are genetic protectors that don't allow the virus to protect. And again, that's been the source of research. Can we somehow replicate that? Very important observations. And you're a very important patient, of course, because the virus has not progressed and without treatment. But that's not true of 99% of the world's population. So it's important from a research point of view. But what will that result in? I'm not certain. And it's not that we shouldn't do research. My point really is we have the answers. That's why we did all of this research up until 1996. And why aren't we implementing that? I mean, why are these people so unimportant in poor countries that we're just going to go on and do a vaccine?
I'm getting a lot of people who want to know what they can do to help.
Yeah. So I think
I'm getting a lot of those comments. Thoughts?
Well, what you can do to help is really become advocates and say that women and children in poor countries need to be treated, and there are things that we do. So, you know, write to Congress, write to people, advocate it with your friends and say, we don't want to forget this epidemic. There are things that you can do. We wrestle with it in terms of our own foundation, Global Strategies. We're small, but we are in some of the most remote, unstable areas, saying that we can bring life-saving drugs to these people who would be otherwise ignored. So support the different programs in your area that are trying to help people and to advocate for them. Poor people and women and children just can't get access in our political system. And that's true here in this country, and that's true. So help them. Help them get access and say, we need health care. It's important that we get it.
And again, Arthur Ammon is the author of Lethal Decisions, The Unnecessary Deaths of Women and Children from HIV/AIDS. He's also founder of Global Strategies and clinical professor of pediatrics at UCSF. And it's good to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
And we are going to have another segment coming up, completely changed directions. We're going to talk with the author of a new biography of the poet Elizabeth Bishop, and I hope you will join us for that. Elizabeth Bishop, as I describe her, very high on the literary stock exchange, much more than anybody would have imagined during her own period of writing poetry and not necessarily having the recognition that she deserved, because she only wrote about 100 poems total in her lifetime. But we'll hear all about her. That's coming up with Megan Marshall, a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and biography of Elizabeth Bishop, A Miracle for Breakfast. Stay tuned. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.